The relationship between rock band and record label has always been a very tricky tightrope to walk. We all know stories told from both sides of the fence. Some resemble horror stories, others sound like winning a gold ticket or rubbing a magical lamp. Whatever the case, both parties are dependent on each other. And for me, as a music fan, there have been times I've placed blind faith in one or the other to lead me to where the good music is. Of course, when you cross the line and assume one of the two sides, in my case that's the band side, you quickly realize just how hazardous it can be on the front lines. We've had our ups and downs with labels in the past, but to be fair, we've also had our tussles with the egomaniacal dispositions adopted by some bands out there too. So, all in all, I've stayed in the game, stayed the course, and come out still a big booster of bands and labels alike. Loyally checking out releases, making note of which label puts out what band, and keeping my music fandom intact, despite what I've been witness to behind closed doors. One label I've always kept a watchful eye on and been loyal to one degree or another is Metal Blade Records. In the high turnover, short-term, transitory world that is the music biz, not to mention the greatly lowered stakes upon its entrance into the digital age, it is quite commendable that Metal Blade, in its 32 years of putting out heavy music, which for all intents and purposes remains a niche market, is still on an upward trajectory. Where other labels and bands get stuck associated with a certain sound or era, ultimately denoting them as passé, Metal Blade, like a ninja, has managed to successfully continue regardless of fleeting trends that come and go in or out of the scene. From the outside, Metal Blade may appear to be an easy template to replicate, but one must recognize the vital enthusiasm of its founder, Brian Slagle, to be the essential component for the label's success. Brian has carved a career out of turning people onto bands, whether they're on his label or not, as I experienced firsthand. After this episode was taped, I found myself going down an Iron Maiden rabbit hole I had not journeyed down in quite some time. And it was only due to listening to Brian talk about them in the short period of time we talked. Seems he has that innate ability of turning people onto bands in a way I don't see in too many people in the music biz anymore. Of course, this talent has to be put to good use. And it has, over decades, introducing the world to bands like Armored Saint, Rat, Fate's Warning, Cirith Ungol, Hyrax, Trouble, Voivod, Corrosion of Conformity, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Atheist, Sacred Reich, Sacrifice, and of course, Metallica and Slayer. The Metal Blade Registry puts pretty much all metal labels to shame, and when you look at the breadth and the monumental role some of its bands have played in the history of the genre, Metal Blade could arguably be called the greatest metal label in history. The bands I just listed have played such a significant role in shaping my musical taste and my personal experience with popular music, period. To be able to meet and talk to the man behind all of this was a distinct pleasure. Even today, Metal Blade exerts such a great influence on the scene through its current roster like Behemoth, Amon Amarth, Portrait, Below, Goat Whore, Whitechapel, co-releasing bands with Rise Above Records like Uncle Acid and the Deadbeats, Church of Misery, and Ghost, and most recently, comedians like Don Jameson, Jim Florentine, and of course, Richard Christie's Charred Walls of the Damned. The list is long, thorough, and impressive. Brian and I had gone back and forth about meeting up to record this episode for over a year. Recently, the CMW, the Canadian Music Week Conference, gave us the opportunity when he was booked to talk on a panel. And despite us being in pre-production for our next record, I scrambled to make this happen. Early evening mix-ups from my end only made me more determined to make it happen, so glad it did. I want to thank, a very special thanks to Phil from Sacred Reich and Don Jameson for helping me prep for this podcast. So thank you very much, guys. It was very helpful. As you'll hear, their help came in handy bringing focus to this podcast with a guy whose shadow is cast over dozens and dozens of bands spanning three decades. It's also pretty cool that both have put out records on Brian's label. Thanks to Skull Candy Headphones and Blue Mic Microphones for supporting the podcast. Thanks to Brian for doing this, and thanks to you for tuning in. We were recently able to pass the 250,000 mark, and we're now gunning for 500,000 listens. So, thank you. Here it is. Brian Slagle is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-host. I love for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down. Down. They told him he was too crazy to rock and roll. But now, he's going to talk their ears off. Danko's got a podcast, and he won't shut up.
It's the one and only, your boy, Danko Jones.
I am in Brian Slagle's hotel suite, Diamond Hotel Suite. This is pretty plush.
Ridiculous.
For the Canadian Music Week, Brian flew into Toronto, and I've been monitoring you on Twitter and your whereabouts, and anytime I get any inkling that you're anywhere near Toronto, I throw it out to you. If you can ever in the vicinity, please, we got to do a podcast.
Yeah, no problem. It's been way too long since I've been to Toronto anyway. I think it's been like 4 years, so I'm way overdue to get up here. So
I think the last time I reached out to you for this was like a year and a half ago about the Indie, the Molson Canadian Indie, I think. You were thinking of coming up here.
Yeah, I was trying to. My schedule is always so wacky, so it's always tough, but this week worked out all right. So
it worked out for me too, actually.
And I keep missing you whenever you play in LA too. It's like I'm always out of town when you're there too, which is a bummer.
Yeah, it's sucks. And then I think even one time in Europe, I don't know, I tweeted you and I said, are you gonna be here? It was for, like, I think there was like two Metal Blade bands playing, you tweeted about it, and I'm like, are you going to be here? Because I got my mics, man. So this time, despite what happened earlier today, I am prepared.
All right, good.
More prepared than I would have been if we had done it earlier.
All right, good. Well, I'm not prepared. I'm not scared.
Yeah. No. It's a huge thing to have you on the podcast, because anybody who knows me knows I'm a rock guy, I'm a metal guy, and your name is almost synonymous with metal now. I mean, Metal Blade is Metal Blade. I mean,
we're old, very old.
It goes without saying. I mean, a lot of the stuff on you and a lot of the interviews, I might be wrong, but they talk about the First Metal Massacre and obviously the people on it.
Yep.
They always go to one band and they don't go to the other band. And I love both bands. How did you get rat on the First Metal Massacre? What's all that about?
It's actually funny. I've been talking to Stephen Piercy a lot lately, which is kind of cool. This was LA in 1982 or 81. Right. And started, you know, the whole story is working at a record store and all this stuff. And when I started working at the record store, I was really the main reason why I wanted to be there was I was a huge fan of the new wave of British heavy metal.
Right.
And what was going on in Europe, and I wanted to bring that stuff to LA, number one, so I could get copies of it easily. Right. And number two, I could get it to my friends. So I had been working at the record store for a couple of months, and, you know, kind of people were starting to drive up and knew the store had metal. And one of these guys came in one day. It turned out to be the guitar player from the band Bitch, who was also on the Metal Massacres.
Right.
And he said, you know, there's some good heavy metal bands here in LA. I said, there are? Where? He said, come to the Troubadour on Wednesday. So I went to the Troubadour on Wednesday, and for $1, I saw Motley Crue and Rat together for $1. And I was like, wow, and this was early on, too, so Rat was super heavy. Rat was like Judas Priest. They all wore black leather. They had Jiggy Lee was the lead guitar player. They had another guy named Bob who was the other guitar player. He was a big guy in black leather with a gigantic flying V. And they were super heavy.
They weren't Mickey Rat.
No, this was after Mickey Rat.
Okay.
They had just become Rat. And both Rat and Motley at that time were pretty heavy. Like Motley was doing some like heavy stuff.
Too Fast for Love is really heavy to me. And
Too Fast for Love was really light compared to what they were doing before. When I heard
really?
Too Fast for Love, I was like, wow, that's really really light compared to what they were. These bands were European-style metal. You know, Priest, Scorpions, you know, all that great 70s, like pretty heavy stuff. A little Sabbath mixed in there. So anyway, so I started seeing Rat, and I started to get into the whole LA metal scene. I started promoting shows, and I had Rat on a bunch of shows. It's kind of funny, one of the times that they actually used to open for Bitch, believe it or not. And the late Robin Crosby came mm-hmm. up after a show one time and said, "We just can't seem to get an audience. What do we do?" I said, "You'll be fine. Don't worry about it." So I had known them forever, and then it was just kind of natural. Really, the whole album was just me going to all my friends and the bands I knew in LA and saying, "Hey, I'm putting this compilation. Right. Do you want to be on it?"
Well, it's interesting because when I see that lineup, and Black and Blue as well, it's easy for people today into the metal scene to really let that go because, I mean, the camps have kind of mixed and crossed over. But back then, maybe even before these lines were drawn is when that compilation came out.
There were no lines drawn then. It was just there was a small scene there with maybe 10 bands at most. It was really all the bands on that. Malice, Steeler, Bitch. Really, Steer the Ungle was kind of the outcast band from that time period. They were up in Ventura doing something really weird at the time, kind of from everybody else. But all the other bands, I mean, everybody played together. They all got along. You know,
I hear stories about Paul Bailoff and how you know he divided the line so much when it came to bands like Rat and Motley Crue sure. and Slayer and Metallica.
Well, what happened, I think, in LA was, like you said, you know, you thought Two Pass Thrill was heavy. That was really pretty light. And they also went, also the way they looked changed. Like they started with the bigger hair, because before it's just all they look like Judas Priest,
right?
Long hair, no hairspray, no nothing. Then Motley kind of got a little bit into the glam thing, and then Rat followed them, and all of a sudden you had all these other bands that were coming around that were doing the same thing, and that's really where the line started to get drawn. It really was drawn even before Slayer with Armored Saint. The Armored Saint was a different band. They didn't hang out with the Hollywood bands. They were from Pasadena. They were much heavier and looked much heavier. So that was kind of the first band in that direction. And then there were clear lines because you had Slayer, Armored Saint, you know, Omen, Savage Grace, all these sort of heavy European-style bands. And then you had Rat and Motley and Hans Noddy, a bunch of other crazy bands that were kind of going in the more glam direction. So there was a clear line there. But in 82, when that Metal Massacre record came out, there weren't any lines.
Right. That's it's really cool. And I think it's come around since then. I see people having Slayer patches with, like, you know, not Poison patches, but like Motley Crue. The people can't really tell the lines too much anymore.
Well, I'm old. So to me, you know, I was not in the Poison Striper camp at all. But a lot of my friends who were, you know, 37 and younger, like to like Striper is perfectly fine. Not a problem. Along with all the other heavy stuff. And to a little degree, you know, Poison is there too. They don't have the delineage that we kind of had back then.
Your new foray, Metal Blade, has always kind of, you know, when you hear the name, it's kind of like Metallica. No matter how far out they've taken their sound, I've always said, like, they will never get away from the fact that metal is in the name of the band. I don't give a shit. If you bring a symphony in, it's still going to zap. You still are tied to metal. So the same with Metal Blade. And over the years, you guys have signed, like there's been like Goo Goo Dolls on there. Gypsy Hawk is a band that comes to mind that's doesn't really strike me as an Amon Amarth kind of band. You know, it's more rock.
Sure.
It's got the more rock feel. But now the new foray is comedy. And so I'm very interested in how you came about meeting and signing Don Jameson first.
Well, first of all, I have to say I'm a huge fan of comedy. I have been stand-up for a long time. I was really super lucky in the 80s to be around in Hollywood at that time because Sam Kinison had just started out. In fact, my good friend Lizzie Borden told me, "You got to come see this comedian." So we went to the Comedy Store, and he went on at one. He was the last guy on at 1:30 in the morning. There were 8 people in there, and he destroyed like I've never. Still to this day, never seen anybody destroy him. I walked out, my cheeks hurt, my stomach hurt. I couldn't breathe. It was so funny. So I was, and we saw Richard Pryor and George Carlin, all these people there. So I've always kind of fascinated by comedy and always thought, you know, maybe someday. And in fact, at the time, the girl I was going out with actually was good friends with the girl that Sam was going out with, Sam Kinison at the time. So I kind of got up my – we kind of talked a few times and, you know, became semi-friendly. So at one point I said, yeah, you know, I have this record company. You know, maybe we could do a comedy record. He said, well, I'm doing this HBO special first. Let me see what happens with that. And if nothing happens, then let's talk. And, of course, the rest is history.
Holy shit.
So I've always been a big fan of it. And I ran into Don at a Charred Walls of the Damned, which is another comedian.
Right.
And also drummer Richard Christie from the Howard Stern Show side project. When he put out his first record, we had a party in New York City, and Don was there. And Don came and said, I've been wanting to meet you for a long time, and, you know, I'm a comedian, and yada, yada. And, I'd heard of his name before, so we became friends there. And he kind of came up with the idea, said, why don't you do a record with me? And I was like, that's an interesting equation. So we like to – what we do these days is almost more – branding really than anything else. I mean, even the record company, I think the main thing for us is, my attitude is, if we build whatever the band is, the brand of that band, right, up, then you're naturally going to sell CDs.
Yeah.
So we kind of took Don, we decided to sign Don. He had no Twitter, no Instagram. His Facebook was barely in existence. His website was a mess. And we recreated all of that stuff for him and kind of set it up and then did the comedy CD. It was a blast. So much fun to do. So obviously his good friend is Jim Florentine, and then that, you know, kind of graduated over to there. But Don was our first ever comedy signing. So now we're doing quite a bit of it, scarily enough.
Well, I know each of them have two albums out on Metal Blade now.
Yep.
Is there a third comedian on board?
Jim Brewer.
Oh, Brewer. Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, we signed him.
Well, that makes total sense.
It's going to be not. It's not going to be a stand-up record. He's actually going to do a music record, which is pretty cool. I've heard some of the stuff he's doing it with Rob Caggiano from Volbeat and Anthrax, who's going to produce it. And it's it's going to be obviously serious music, but the lyrical content will be very tongue-in-cheek and funny. He's getting some special guests on there, so that's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, it's funny because I played Vakken. I spoke at Vakken 2 years ago, and I was on the same day as Brewer. So we did a podcast together. I knocked on his dressing room door, and we did it. And I told him, and you could hear it on the podcast, and it was totally genuine. I said, you sang with Halford, and nobody, like, you, I don't care if you're a comedian, like, you can't get, most guys in bands can't even fucking keep up with Halford. You're going line for line, toe to toe, verse for verse with him. Why aren't you, like, taking this more seriously than you are? You should really fucking go for it. I can't remember the song. You can hear it on
the Halford thing.
Yeah,
I remember him. I remember him doing it. There's another one he just did that was pretty funny. It's a Christmas song he put out on his own. It's pretty similar to what he's doing here. It's like a real super heavy riff with a Santa Claus. But it's interesting that, you know, we're kind of, you know, moving in that direction. But honestly, it's a very difficult world, comedy. It's a lot of people don't buy comedy stuff. It's very digital friendly, mainly driven by iTunes and that stuff. So we'll see. My attitude is, like, if we do well with Brewer's thing, and then, you know, maybe we'll do a little bit more comedy. So we'll see.
Well, when I heard that you were putting it out, I immediately knew that you were a comedy fan. Okay. Without even having read or heard anything about it, I just knew, well, then that means that Slagle's a comedy fan, because nobody would do it in 2010 or whenever the first Jameson record came out. And knowing those guys and knowing how it's kind of like a band. They're kind of like bands where rock bands like cite like all their influences and stuff. And you hang out with Florentine enough and Jameson, it's all about, you know, Dice and Kinison. They talk about these guys like people talk about Kiss and Black Sabbath.
Well, that's the cool thing about both Don and Jim. You know, not only, you know, we've done a lot of work with them, but they become really good friends of mine too. I was at Jim's wedding, and, you know, Don was at my wedding, and so it's really cool. But they're massive metalheads. I mean, they're no joke. Like, you talk to them and they know everything about everybody, and it was always fun. We have, you know, I mean, you see it on that metal show. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
we have the same talks that they have there all the time, so it's fun.
Yeah, that's the greatest thing about that show, is everybody tunes in because it's very reminiscent of their own conversations.
Exactly, and that's really how that show started in the first place. Was Eddie would have those guys on his radio show, and they do have the same talk, and they'd be like, we should really do something more with this. So,
it's funny how I first met Florentine. It was in Philadelphia. I was sitting there we do these van tours, and I made this van tape or this van CD of all these crank calls, and we just drive and we listen to these crank calls. And one of them was this guy with this crazy voice, just the most obnoxious voice. And so we're sitting there in the Philadelphia station, WYSP, and then in walks this guy, and he goes, "Hey, I'm a big fan. Jason McMaster told me about you guys." And I'm just listening to, and I'm like, "Fuck, I think I've heard I know who you are. Like, do you do those phone calls and stuff?" And that's how we met and clicked, and that was like almost 10 years ago. It was Florentine.
Crazy. Yeah, it's hard to have a serious conversation with him because you always think that voice is just hysterical.
Yeah, and it's for real. It's not even, it's just how he talks. Yeah, and it's great, and those phone calls are just fucking hilarious.
Oh, yeah, brilliant.
And I've used it. Actually, I've like lifted theirs and used it on people who call my place. So
nice.
It's pretty cool.
Awesome.
I know they did like 4 terrorizing telemarketers.
Yep.
Is there any kind of thought of re-releasing them in any way?
They're all out, actually. They're all out. Steve Vai's label actually put out, I want to say, three or four of them.
Oh, okay.
And then another label also put out all that stuff. So they're still out, and they're still available and doing well and stuff. So,
oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. There.
If it was available, I'd love to do it, but yeah, other people have it, so.
I asked a few people, Jim and Don, if there's any questions I could ask.
Oh, no, I'm scared now. Now I'm scared.
No, it was real easy. But Don's ask him about his hockey jersey.
No.
Collection,
exactly.
Which apparently is out of control.
Yeah, I have 2,500 hockey jerseys, all different teams. I have basically a jersey from almost any team that ever existed up until probably the last 5 years, minor league, international, everything. And then of those, I have about 750 game-worn jerseys. And game-worn jerseys mean they're worn in actual hockey games.
Oh, okay.
So, and most of those, probably about 80%, probably 80% of those are minor league stuff. I got really big into minor league hockey in the 90s, and then I also got big into eBay. And eBay you could buy this stuff for basically nothing. These teams would just get rid of their jerseys. They'd just be like, "Hey, here's a whole bunch of jerseys for nothing." So I got, eBay-aholic and bought all these jerseys. So I have this massive jersey collection now. It's so ridiculous.
And then he also asked me, told me to ask you about your Iron Maiden bootleg collection.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm a collector, as you could probably tell by all of these things. Yeah, I basically have from the existence of Iron Maiden in 1981 through the Seventh Son of Seventh Son tour in 1988, about 90% of every single, about 90% of all the shows they ever did in that time period. So if you said, "I went to Iron Maiden in Toronto in 1986, I'm sure I have it.
How do you, like, this is the thing that I always ask people like you. How the fuck do you find it? Like, I want to do it too. Like, my whole thing is I collect Metallica DVD bootlegs. That's my thing. I gave up because I couldn't keep up.
Yeah,
after
so many
200.
Of them, yeah.
I was just like, well, this is ridiculous. Either I go for it and forget, fuck everything else, or just like be happy with what I have.
Well, I started out actually before I even got to work at the record store, did the fans or anything. I was a bootlegger when I was a kid. When I was 17, I would go to concerts and stick a tape recorder down my pants and record every single show I could record. So I started really early. So I have a lot of stuff from that time period. And it got pretty big. At one point, I had probably the fifth largest collection in the U.S. But it's a little tricky back then because it's super illegal, especially then. People were freaking out about it. So I got out of it. A couple of the guys who had bigger collection than I did, it sold a lot. I ended up getting busted and going to prison. So I got out, luckily. Yeah,
scary. I never knew that they would take it that far.
Well, these guys were, I would sell a little bit here and there, mainly to fund my habit of buying records because I was poor when I grew up. But these guys were big time. I mean, they were selling tons and tons of stuff. So they were probably making a lot of money,
right,
too.
Oh, okay.
Which was not cool. But so anyway, I started early. And then just over the years, I've been able to, between, just knowing people. And like, for example, I used to go to Japan all the time. And that's the haven for all this stuff now.
Shinjuku. And
yeah, exactly. So I'd meet people there. And I'm a huge Iron Maiden collector. So I collect probably of anything I have. Iron Maiden is, they're still my favorite band of all time. And I still, I don't collect nearly as much as I used used to, but I, for a while there, I was a crazy collector. So I have, you know, almost everything that ever existed in Iron Maiden world, including these. And I ran it, just ran into some, it wasn't even just me, some guy had somehow amassed these, all of these tapes. I probably had maybe 40% of all the Maiden shows. And I found this guy, I can't even remember where, how it came about, but he had these, he put them on DVDs, and they were basically all, you know, almost every Maiden show. So I gave him a bunch of the stuff that I had to complete his thing, and then he gave me all the stuff he had. So it's crazy.
Right. So your collection is audio, obviously.
Yep.
But, I mean, now that it's 2014, are there still cassettes? And
I kept all my cassettes. I have them, but I've transferred all of my live stuff onto computer. So all the live CDs and all the live cassettes I have, everything all on computers now. So I have like a couple of different laptops that have everything in it, because I probably have, I don't know, several thousand live shows from all over the place. So it's actually funny. I was talking with Randy Johnson, the pitcher.
Right, yeah.
You're not a sports fan, so
no, but
you may not know, but hopefully some people on the podcast know. It's Hall of Fame pitcher. We were talking, and he's a photographer now. He's doing all this rock photography, so it's really good, actually. I was going to see him on a Marth. I'm supposed to go see him on a Marth in Phoenix. He said, "Oh, if you come to my house, I have the biggest bootleg collection in the world." I go, we may have to talk about that. So he has a pretty impressive collection, though. But
of Maiden.
He doesn't have as much Maiden. He's got some Maiden, but he's got like Sabbath and Zeppelin and a bunch of other stuff. So
I got caught up in the whole Metallica DVD bootleg thing a few years ago.
It's hard, man, because even like Metallica, I mean, it's just impossible for, I mean, I try to keep up with some of that stuff, but it would be, it's, there's just too many of it, too much of it.
And what I found after trying to chase that is like, I wasn't even watching it. I was just like marking off the dates.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, oh, I'll just watch this, throw it on. I might as well. And I'm like, oh, this is pretty unwatchable.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I guess at least with an audio tape, you could at least do something else. But you're locked onto the screen watching this kind of shaky cam.
It's a little tough. I have a ton of bootleg DVDs and stuff as well. So, but I realized the other day that that's changed so much. I got an Iron Maiden Blu-ray bootleg DVD from their show.
Wow.
In one of the shows in I think it was Brazil. It was broadcast on TV. And I mean, it's like perfect quality.
Yeah.
Like, how can you watch anything else almost after that?
That's pretty cool. I have a couple of those in my Metallica collection, but I...
Well, don't, if you're a big Metallica fan, if you'll probably, your head will explode if you ever go to Lars's house.
Oh.
Because he has a, I don't know, it's like almost like it's a warehouse basically, housing pretty much every show they've ever done on either audio or video.
I've heard that he collects the set list.
Yeah.
He's all.
Yeah, he's got all that stuff. But I went in, I remember going in there, it's like, it's pretty impressive. It's like, wow.
But there's this one clip I saw, and it became the one bootleg, Metallica bootleg, that I was trying to find, because I saw Metallica on this French talk show, and they cut to this footage of, you know, I think it was Breaking Edge Festival from 84, and it's Cliff Burton, and it's really bright, it's really crisp. The footage is in perfect condition, and then they cut back to Lars, and Lars is like, "I want that. Where yeah, is
really?
It?" So he doesn't have it, or wow. At least he didn't.
Excuse me, I'm sure he has it now.
Yeah, probably. That became the thing that I was. I never found it, but
oh really? France, 1984.
84, and it's just fucking phenomenal.
Amazing. Yeah, I'll have to look around.
The footage is really crisp and clear, and I'm surprised it's not on the.
I'll make a note of it, because I've got a bunch of stuff, and I know, you know, like I said, I know a bunch of people in that world, so I'll have to see if it's out there.
Yeah, and I tried to find it, and I saw other collectors online. Makes it easier now to like,
yep,
find people, and they were looking for it too. Well, so I'm like, well, there's just no way I can find this thing. It's probably locked up in Lars's, you know, house now.
I'll text him now if you want.
That kind of stuff scares the shit out of me. Actually, when we played Soundwave, I was with Ian from Billy Talent, the guitar player from Billy Talent, and Metallica threw a barbecue the first day of the tour, which I thought was really nice.
Oh, yeah, they're great
and
guys.
They showed, all four of them showed up. You know, some stuck around for shorter than others.
Mm-hmm.
But James was the fucking man. He went to every little kind of, and it's all the bands were invited.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get a bunch of fucking, you know, fucking, everybody's going ape shit over James Hetfield, and including myself. So I was positioning myself wherever I thought James would end up. The next group of people, I thought he'd end up, and he'd always go the other way. And he wasn't doing it on purpose. It was just the way things happened. And then finally, me and Ian from Billytown, we were the last people to go up to him. And then by the time we finally got him, he was done. I mean, yeah. he was such a trooper. The other guys are long gone.
No, wow.
And all he kept doing was whatever we'd say, I was like, yeah, we're from Toronto. Toronto, great place. Like, he was done. He just repeated what we said and gave it a little compliment. But Lars was the one guy I just did not want to go up to. Not because I don't like, I'm just so intimidated by Lars.
Really? It's funny because, you know, I mean, obviously I've known those guys forever. And, like, I mean, Lars is still one of my best friends. Mm. And you get that all the time. It used to be really James, because people, especially like in the 90s, when I'd go to shows and kids would be backstage getting autographs. I go, you guys get his autograph? They go, we got everybody but James. And why didn't you get James? I was afraid of him. Like, he's like, come on, he's a pussycat. We'll go. Come on. Get it done. So Lars is the same way.
No, you know, like some kind of monster, that scene when he goes to the ballet recital. That was it for me. I'm like, nah, James is... I can get his autograph. but Lars, for some reason, and then because, you know, over the years I've kind of like, I've always felt and I've always thought that back in the Metallica camp, and I know those guys have their ears to the ground, I have not held back on my fandom for Metallica, good or bad. If I have a criticism about them, I'll say it publicly and openly. And I feel as a fan, I have kind of that right to exercise it, because my loyalty is unflinching. So I've said a few things that Blabbermouth have fucking picked up on, so I've just like stayed away, and I'm like, I just prefer to be a fan. Having said that, Kirk actually emailed me once. It was like we were on tour, and I got this crazy email address that looked like spam, and something inside me said, click it. Like, I never do that. And it was just, it was Kirk, and he was drunk, and he goes, I'm hanging out with Mark Asagueda from Death Angel. We're listening to you guys, you fucking blood. He was obviously drunk.
That's awesome.
And I was like, holy fuck. And one of our guys was in the shower taking a shower. I'm like, fucking John, open up, John. He thought I was getting killed. And he's, what the fuck, what's going on? I go, I think Kirk Hammett just fucking emailed me. And then I go, I don't know though. This could be a fucking joke. So I emailed Mark and I said, Mark, there's a guy posing as Kirk Hammett saying that he's hanging out with you. He goes, no, it fucking happened.
Yeah,
and it was really cool. And then we met at Rock'em Ring, and he came in. We went to their world.
Camp, yep.
Yeah. And we were led in by a guy. You look at him, and I'm like, you could tear me apart with your bare hands. One of those kinds of guys. And then he came in, and it was an hour to showtime. And they were obviously jamming. He had his guitar. And he started playing our riffs
awesome.
To me. And he's like, how do you play this? And it was the one moment in my life where I fucking had vertigo. Like, I couldn't answer him. So JC, our bass player, had to answer him for me. I didn't even know what it was. And then afterwards, I'm like, what was the riff that he played? And he told me the song. And
they're just human beings like the rest of
us. I know, but I'm just like, they're just my favorite band. Kiss are my favorite bands.
I get you. I mean, Kiss is a huge, Kiss was my favorite band in the 70s when I was a kid. But Iron Maiden to this day is my favorite band. And I'm still... Like, I met Steve Harris like twice. I interviewed him once in '81 for my fanzine, and I met him once briefly in Nashville on this last run. And you know, I tell like the Anthrax guys and all this stuff, you know, because they all know I'm a huge. You've never met Steve? I said, well, I mean, kinda, but I just same thing. I would be a little kind of stumbly there.
Man.
I mean, he's probably the only guy. I think him and Tony Iommi, the only two guys that would ever intimidate me, because I'm so used to dealing with bands. Just that,
right?
All, you know. If I'm at Bono tomorrow, I'll be like, yeah, cool. How you doing, man?
Yeah.
You know, whatever. But those two guys, especially Harris. But I know Bruce really well.
Oh, that's cool.
And I'm really good friends, believe it or not, with Rod Smallwood, which still kind of blows me away. He's like an unbelievably great guy. And always, every time I go to a show, he gives passes and the whole thing and hang out with him. And go to dinner with him and hung out like afterwards. Great guy. But it still kind of blows me. It's like, wow, I'm friends with Rod Smallwood. That's so
bizarre.
That's
pretty heavy, yeah. That's like next level Maiden fan. Like yeah, next exactly. level. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
He knows I'm a fan, but I still don't think he knows to what degree I'm a fan.
So. Right.
But the thing that people don't understand about Metallica is they know all the stuff. They know Load was a big departure. They know Reload is not a good record. They know Saint Anger is not a good record. And they especially know Lulu isn't a good record. When they did the 30th anniversary shows, they even were joking about, like, you know, that sort of stuff on stage. Yeah. About even the night Lou Reed was there, they were joking about that stuff. So they understand all of it. It's just, you know, I think for them, you know, they like to do things differently and take risks and just, you know, I mean the thing with them, I always make the argument, like, they're never whatever album they're making is based on whatever they're listening to at the time. So Load and Reload sound like that because they were obsessed with 70s rock and metal. Thin Lizzy, Blue Oyster Cult, Bachman Turner Overdrive. That's all they were listening to. So that's kind of how those records sounded. When they did Saint Anger, they were obsessed with System of a Down.
Yeah.
And then when they did Death Magnetic, they came back to the new wave of British heavy metal. In fact, Lars called me and said, like, we're starting to think about writing another record. I've lost all my copies of the New Wave of British Heavy Metal album that he actually did, that we put out in the States with a compilation of all the best of stuff. He said, can you send me a few of those so I can give them to the guys and we can, you know, kind of rediscover that stuff? So, sure. So they got back into all of that stuff, and hence you have a record like Death Magnetic, which sounds like the early stuff.
Yeah, I honestly I love Death Magnetic.
And phenomenal.
A lot of people were going, like, every time I talk up Death Magnetic, people were like, the one guy goes, well, it's not Ride the Lightning, right? And I'm like, dude, you've had over 20 years to live with Ride the Lightning. You have life experiences with those songs. How is it ever going to match? Just listen to it as a record.
Of course.
That you would as a, like, you know.
Well, not only that, I mean, here's a band. I mean, look, they're arguably in one of the three biggest bands in the world right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Whenever has a band at that status ever gone back and done something really credible that's like their early stuff? I mean, and doing something super heavy like that. I mean, never. I mean, nobody's been able to do that. So, you know, people discount that record a little bit, but it's like, yeah, but you got to take it in the context of, you know, where they're at in their career and how huge they are. I mean, it's not easy for them to even have the record company say, like, yeah, you know, do a record with a whole bunch of really long, super heavy songs.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you on that. But my thing with Lulu was, and it was a total joke, because I sometimes feel like, you know, I bust balls on bands like Metallica and Kiss. I do it publicly, but it's only meant in fun, because I tweeted, I go, listening to Lulu right now. And then I go,
why?
Yeah, like, this is before the album came out.
Ah, okay.
And then I go, listen. And then the next day I go, listen to Lulu last night. Metallica collection up for sale this morning. Like, and I took a picture. I spread out all my, like, records, and I took a photo and I tweeted the photo, and Blabbermouth picked up on it. And for 2 days, it was nonstop. This is before people had heard Lulu. Nonstop hatred from all these fucking Metallica fans tweeting me, going, "Who the fuck are you? Fuck you!" I'm like, oh my god, I think those. You know, I just created a monster.
Yeah, exactly. Well, some people don't have a sense of humor, I guess.
Yeah, it was a joke. For a guy to have that many Metallica records, I must be a fan, too.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, it's humorless.
Their fans are funny, because it's one way or the other. It's either way. I hate them now because they don't do the old stuff, or they love them and everything, can't do any wrong. So, Kiss fans, so I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure, yeah.
So, what is your opinion of the current Kiss lineup?
I am all for it. But I would prefer that the new members take on new makeup. That's what I really think, that doing Tommy Thayer's Spaceman and Eric's singer as the Catman, it should, like, just that in the same tradition as the Fox and the Ankh Warrior, they should be new characters.
I completely agree. Yeah. It's funny because when I was 14, Kiss was my favorite band. I made homemade Kiss shirts and wore them to school. So I'm actually reading. I'm going through all the autobiographies now. Yeah, I read. Well, I read Gene's a long time ago, so I have to go back and reread it again. But I did. Yeah, I did Peter's, and I just finished Ace, and I'm just starting with Paul's, and I'm gonna go back and read Gene. So it's interesting to get the different takes from those guys, because I've met Gene quite a few times actually, and I think I met Paul once and Ace once for like 2 seconds, and I actually interviewed Peter Criss. I've done a radio show since 1990. Still doing it, but I used to do it in Phoenix on the local Z-Rock show. So I interviewed him once for 2 hours. Like, could not be a nicer guy. So it's interesting to get their different takes on, you know, the career and what happened and stuff.
Well, it's interesting you'd say that about Peter Criss, because Peter Criss's autobiography, out of the three that I've read, I'm reading Paul's next week on the plane on tour. But Peter's, I found, he came off as the most unsympathetic at the end of the read.
Kinda, yeah. I was kind of surprised at that.
He threw himself under the bus.
Kinda, yeah. I mean, I think I mean, I went back and forth with that on his book, because sometimes I go, ah, what an asshole, and then other times I go, well, you know, I kind of understand what he was doing. But I mean, meeting him a few times, he couldn't be a sweeter guy.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to see where he came from, and I was really surprised by Ace's book, because, you know, I've met Ace a couple times, and he's never been fully coherent, really. But I thought his book was awesome and really well done, the guy's like, okay, he's a really, I mean, you know. Ed Trunk's a good friend of mine, and obviously he's good friends with Ace, and you know, I've only heard great things from him about Ace and how smart he is. And I didn't really realize it until, like, wow, that guy is pretty freaking smart.
But
it's a good book.
The thing is, I've said this because Marty Friedman is a huge Kiss fan too, mm-hmm. and we've done a Kiss-only podcast before, and we did one already, and that's the next episode.
Oh, cool.
So we talk about this, and both of us are on the same side with all this Kiss stuff, and we agree on most things about Kiss. And the one book I think will be the most coherent and the most truthful will be Paul's.
Yeah, I heard it's real. I just really started, so I'm only like a couple pages in. But I do know from a couple friends of mine who read it said it's really, really good. So,
because he's the one, he strikes me as like, he's not as like ego-driven as Gene and full of himself. And yet,
I don't know, though. You hear reports, though. I mean, even if you read Ace and Peter's book, I mean, Gene probably comes off the worst a little bit. But Paul, you know, he's not the you know, everything's all good either. And I heard that he was the one that really laid the hammer down about the original band not playing at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Like, Gene was actually all for it, and Paul said, "I will not play with those guys ever again." That's what I heard. I could be wrong, but it was fairly credible sources.
I'm a Paul fan when it comes to these things, and I agree with Paul. I'm team Paul.
So you would not want to see the original guys at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I would, but I mean, I understand knowing the whole story and just how they were treated and treated. I mean, fuck, these are fucking multimillionaires. But
yeah, I know exactly.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. But I mean, just the way that the whole thing went down. I mean, if I was in Paul's position, I'd take a stand too.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can't blame those guys. I mean, you know, if you read both Peter and Ace, I mean, they were fucked up most of the time. And I can imagine being, I mean, I just know from my dealing with bands, I don't want to deal with bands that are fucked up. Like, if they're not responsible, if they're not going to do stuff, they're hooked on drugs and all that. I mean, it's just not worth the hassle, no matter how big they are. So I get it from that level. But it's tough, you know, from the fan base, because, I mean, that's the band, you know.
But here's the thing is, Eric Singer's been in the band for 23 years.
Eric's great. I mean, I don't really have a big problem with Eric, because I think he's a really good drummer. I mean, it's still weird seeing him wearing the makeup, but the whole Tommy Thayer is Ace. I mean, he plays fine, and he's a great guitar player, but there's just a whole tone thing there that's so different.
Yeah.
Like, most people, I can't go see it now. I watched them. I went to see them when they first did that. Them and Aerosmith played in Vegas.
Right.
I went to see that. I was just so bummed out by, you know, it just wasn't the same. And because when they did the reunion tours, I think I saw 32 of those shows.
Holy fuck.
I'm a huge Kiss fan. I mean, I was at all four of the Long Beach Arena shows where they did a live two. I mean, I saw them countless times. I was at the Phantom of the Park when they did that disaster.
What? You were?
I was there, yeah. I won tickets to go. They had a concert there, so I won tickets to go.
So technically, you're in the movie.
Theoretically, yeah. There was a dot somewhere.
The shape of your head is.
Yeah, but that was the end of me being a Kiss fan, because they started explaining how the movie was going to go, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be terrible. And that day, When I was there, they were playing over the loudspeaker this amazing album, and I was trying to. I was like, nobody knew what it was. I even went up to the guy that was at the soundboard and said, "Do you know what who this is?" Like, oh, I have no idea. And they played it over and over. And I'm like, man, this is so good. So I started to kind of try to remember some of the choruses, so I might think of the song titles. And I went in, maybe a week later, I was in the local record store flipping around, and I said, oh, I think I found the record. It was AC/DC Powerage.
Wow.
And that's when I went from being a Kiss fan, is Kiss my favorite band, to being AC/DC my favorite band.
Right.
Next.
The other person who I sent out any questions if you had, he emailed me back with like 20 questions, but it's Phil from Sacred Reich.
Oh, cool.
And
Phil rules.
Aside from like the joke questions,
yeah,
there's like half of them are joke questions. I'm just trying to like field them all, like, you know, who is your best friend, like these kinds of things. Who do you like more, James or Lars? You know, who wins the Canadian Power Trio death match between Rush, Triumph, and Anvil?
Rush.
Yeah.
That's an easy one.
And who is your favorite new wave of British heavy metal band?
Iron Maiden.
Of course, yes. But anyways.
James or Lars. I'm more close to Lars because, I mean, I've known him much longer, but I'm good friends with both of those guys.
Yes.
So I'm probably, but I'm much closer to Lars than James. Always has been that way.
There's just so many questions. Like, seriously.
Let me see.
I'll
answer the ones that make sense. Let me see here. All right, Phil, you're crazy. What people have been pivotal in the rise of metalhead for your mom's garage to wear today? It's no one but me. Come on. No, I'm just kidding. There's a lot of people that have been there for a long time. Mike Fahley's been there for 28 years. Tracy Vera's been there for 23 years. Dan Fitzgerald's been there for 20 years. I mean, most of the people that we have working at Metal Blade have all been there forever. So there's a lot of people. Trust me, it's not just me. Tom or Kerry? That's definitely Kerry. That's really easy. Let's see. Favorite metal band? yeah, I see some of these. Oh, here we go. One person you would love to meet, living, deceased. That is very easy. Phil Lynott. It's the one guy a huge Thin Lizzy fan, so I got to see him twice, technically, in 1979, so with Phil.
Now, have you met his mom? Because she's very public.
Met his mom, unfortunately, only very briefly, but she was unbelievably cool. I wish I had more time to spend with her because she was just so nice. And because we ended up reissuing a bunch of Thin Lizzy records when we were at Warner Brothers in the early 90s, and we did a really good job on it. We remastered everything and made it sound really good. And we also got Warner's to basically what Warner's did, which was really cool, is they wiped out all of Thin Lizzy's debt and they paid the band from record one on that stuff, which was cool. So she got some money. So yeah, couldn't be a nicer person.
So actually, here's a follow up question to that. What, since you asked me about Kiss, what are your feelings about the Black Star Riders and the Thin Lizzy before that?
Well, I saw the first incarnation of that, where it really was a tribute to Phil, which I thought was great. And
yeah,
it had Brian Downey and Scott Gorham and
John Sykes.
Sykes. And so that was really good, and I appreciate that. And I mean, I go back and forth with it because, I mean, I guess I'm happy that they're still around doing it. And the whole theory was, if we're not doing it, we're trying to keep his legacy going. But it also looked a little bit to me to be of a money play because they were doing so many shows, and it kind of got a little old to me. And then when they were talking about making a new record, for a minute they were going to call it Thin Lizzy, and that would have been, to me, blasphemous.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy they didn't do that. I think it's a great record, and the band is really good, so I'm glad they're doing it, but I'm glad they didn't call it Thin Lizzy.
Looking over Phil's questions here, there is one question about Gwar. From the recent events surrounding that band, Gwar were probably one of the greatest shows I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the fact that they were... I think a lot of people got into Gwar and they were kind of a novelty in that sense, where like if they're around, it's something to do. But I think, I'm guilty of it, is like I didn't realize just how consistent they were in putting out all those records. And so now that things have happened, look, what are your thoughts about Gwar and all that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah.
With Odorous. And
yeah, it's just so sucks because, you know, Dave, such a great, just an amazing, great, wonderful human being. And you know, like, when you're, why is the guy gone so quick? It's really a bummer. And, you know, he was super funny, but one of the smartest guys I think I've ever met. I mean, he could talk for hours about World War II, about history, about, I mean, he was like, you know, Harvard level smart. You know, they kind of became, strangely enough, when you look at Gwar way back in the day, so they never could become mainstream, but they really became mainstream. I mean, between, you know, what they're doing with the live shows, what they're doing the music, what Dave was doing with TV, you know, being on TV and all the stuff, and how creative they were doing, and so many things. I mean, everybody knew who Gwar was, and you really saw it. The one thing that that was cool after Dave passed away was just reading all the tweets and this. I mean, just people coming out of the woodwork that you had no idea were huge Gwar fans, which was really awesome. And you realize then how really they've just transcended so many things just by what they were able to do, both musically and visually. And I mean, look, they always got knocked for, you know, oh, it's just a show and the music's not any good. But they, I think, you know, a lot of those records are really good. And I think people slowly over the years started realizing, like, these guys actually are pretty decent musicians, especially when they have to play in front of, you know, all that nuts nonsense they have to wear every night. It's well, not easy.
Well, I always thought Odorous was a great singer. And I knew that there was a bigger personality behind the costume. But I am guilty of the fact that, you know, when they burst out onto the scene, I went to see them in 1990, and then I kind of moved on.
I think that's a lot of people. Just, I mean, people saw it and thought it was really cool. I mean, they've had obviously tons of fans, and they continued to do it for a long time. But it seemed like the last 5 or 6 years is when they really, they certainly perfected what they were doing, I think, finally, and really made it a huge spectacle, and they knew how to do that. And that got so many people back in. I mean, again, they were bigger than they've ever been at this point in time. So it's really, it's just a, I mean, they're definitely going to continue on in some manner, but it's obviously not ever going to be the same without Dave. I mean, he was the guy that, you know, kind of the glue that put it all together, and just the personality on stage. I mean, he'd just say stuff on stage, just stare. I mean, he could have been a stand-up comedian easily.
Yeah, I could sense that.
Totally. We've always talked about forever about doing a spoken word record with him, just letting him go crazy. And we never got around to doing it, but he recorded a bunch of stuff over the years. So I was talking with the guys, and we're going to kind of compile it all together. I think we'll be able to make it happen. So,
well, there's something I put out. It was a 7-inch, and it was based on the Having Fun with Paul Stanley on Stage 7-inch. And I think they did one for Ian MacKaye. And that's a bootleg. They're all bootlegs, but we did our own. And it was just basically the in-between song banter from like a bunch of bootleg shows that I had of our band.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we put a 7-inch out, and I would think you could do a whole... And actually, that's a play on an Elvis one, Having Fun with Elvis on Stage. That's a full album.
That's an interesting idea. Yeah, I mean, there's some amazing stuff there. That's a good idea.
I'm sure there's enough Gwar footage that you could put together like a double album. Anyways, I have to ask this last question from Phil. Is it true that Sacred Reich playing Poison's Talk Dirty to Me was the clincher on offering them a record deal?
No, absolutely not. In fact, if I would have seen or heard them do that, I probably would have not wanted to sign them.
You know, I told Phil this when I met those guys a couple years back at Vakken, actually. And we ended up hanging out for like the whole night, me and Phil, just outside of the hotel. And he's a great guy.
Awesome.
He's amazing. And I told him, I got into Sacred Reich because I saw a Metal Blade ad, I believe in some metal magazine, that said the same label that brought you Metallica and Slayer now bring you the Next Generation. And it was everybody's logo.
Terrible ad. But
Sacred Reich, Sacrifice were in there. And, I mean, I'm from Scarborough, and you know, the Sacrifice guys, you know, I count as friends, like Joe and Rob. And it's just so cool, you know, now to meet Phil the way I know him, you know. And I mean, I'm going to see Sacred Reich and all that stuff. So I told him that, and he was actually, I think he was impressed that that worked, you know.
He like, totally was. He's a funny guy, because, you know, I keep bugging them, like, God, why don't you just do another record?
Oh, I stopped asking.
I know, yeah. I ask them all the time, too. But I think, you know, they, They're having fun now doing what they're doing. They're enjoying it. And I told him, like, look, but you don't have to tour. You can tour just like you're doing it now. You can do some festivals. You can do some dates here. There's not a big commitment. Like, if you put out a record, you're going to tour for 6 weeks. You don't have to do that these days. It's a whole different scenario. But I just think he just doesn't want to – just doesn't want to do it. I saw them two years ago this summer at Hellfest. I hadn't seen them for, I don't know, a few years. And they were on fire. I mean, they were just absolutely on fire. And then they played our 30th anniversary show in L.A. And same thing. He said, we'll come, but we're only going to play three songs. I go, well, and everybody's freaking out for more. He said, nope, we're going to do three. And again, they just absolutely destroyed him. I mean, they're better now. I told them at Hellfest, too. I said, you guys are better now than you were in the heyday, actually. I mean, they're just on fire, sounding amazing.
That Hellfest show is online. I think the whole thing is on.
A lot of those whole Hellfest ones are up there. And they destroyed the place that day. I was blown away. Like, holy cow. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, when I was there in Germany, and they're just like, I saw in the lobby, there's some guy walking around with a Sacred Reich shirt. I'm like, oh, it's just some guy. And but I knew they were playing that day. So I'm like, maybe he's with them. And sure enough, I saw, I think it was Wally walking around or something. I'm like, why do I know that face? Yeah. Like, why do I know that?
Let's go. All the original guys are back. It's awesome.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, they're such an amazing band. It's too bad, but I understand now that you're telling me the situation.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, you know, he hasn't told me what it is, but I can, you know, just kind of surmise more or less, kind of, you know, what the story is.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I mean, I think it's very fitting to end on Sacred Reich.
Awesome.
I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Yeah, no worries.
But thanks, Brian. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.